Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. Emily, I'm so nervous about this conversation. I'm afraid that I'm going to accidentally say the word.
I
don't want to say it. I don't need to say it.
Not on my watch, Jesse.
All right.
You're going to be fine. You're going
to
be
like,
fine.
You have to understand my personality flaws. Yeah. Like, if you told me that whatever I do in this conversation, I can't say the word butterscotch, mm-hmm. I would just be dying. I'm just vibrating.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised by this contrarian instinct. I've seen it at work before. Yeah.
That's like a very noble word to place on something that's more like just a nervous tic or a weird compulsion. But I think I'll be okay. This episode is brought to you by Amy Friel, Nick Heisler, Bronwyn Marsden, Christine Salitzman, Michael McCaughlin, Michael McLaren, Karen Freed, and Judy.
I'm Judy from Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm a writer and social activist and a retired university professor. I support Canada Land because of your critiques of the media, which include critical voices from journalists not often heard in the mainstream media. And of course, Jesse.
Emily Nicolas, a journalist, host of our French language show, Detour. Emily, let's just start by telling the story, I guess. Starts in 2020 when a Montreal man, a black man named Ricardo Lamour, goes into Radio-Canada, French CBC, to the headquarters in Montreal to be a guest on a radio talk show called 1518, right?
That's right.
And as you do, you're sitting there listening to the radio show's like segment before your segment. Lamour is an artist and a social worker. I think he was probably going on the air to talk about some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But while he's waiting, he catches the preceding segment. He's hearing what everybody who's listening to Radio Canada is hearing. What does he hear?
He hears the host, Annie Desrochers, speak to one of her collaborators, Simon Jodoin, and they're discussing how a professor at Concordia University is catching some backlash for using the N-word in class. And she was using the N-word in class because she was discussing the infamous book by Pierre Valière, which I think the polite way to frame it would be White Negroes of America. Mm-hmm. And so that's the context in which this discussion was taking place. I think the N-word was said 3 times in French and 1 time in English with the hard ER during that discussion that Ricardo was listening before coming on the air himself.
So there's a black man listening to the public radio and he hears the N-word 4 times going out live before his segment where he's going to come on and talk about other stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
And he gets through the segment, but then he files a complaint.
Yeah, so he first sends just an email to the show itself saying basically what the fuck. And then I think the show itself says we didn't do anything wrong. And so then after that, he files a formal complaint to the Radio-Canada's ombudsman.
What does the ombudsman say?
The ombudsman says, you know, we follow journalistic standards and there's nothing to see here, basically. So after that happens, he takes it a step further and then complains to the CRTC itself.
And what does the CRTC say?
The CRTC says a whole bunch of things, and that decision took a really long time to take. So we're talking about a segment that was happening in 2020, and the decision just dropped at the end of June this year. So after the CRTC took its sweet time, the majority decision was that it's okay to say the N-word, but you should be careful how many times you use it. Just be careful with the word. Maybe have some sort of warning before and basically suggest Radio-Canada to have some sort of a policy or some steps that they could take to kind of know how to handle that in the future. And it'd be great as well if you could apologize to the listener that filed a complaint. And then there's the minority decisions. There's 2 of them. Some of the arguments are the CRTC is overstepping its boundary. It's stepping out of line by just even getting disinvolved in some of the journalistic decisions that Radio-Canada is making. And they're also saying that the N-word doesn't have the same weight in French and in English, and that it's basically a form of not understanding French specificities.
So there's a split between those at the CRTC who say, yes, you can use this word, but maybe just don't use it so much and be careful about how much you use it and apologize to the person you offended with this. And then the contradictory opinion, which is we shouldn't be saying anything about what you can and can't say.
That's right.
And that's the CRTC's ruling. All of that together is the CRTC's response. And what happens next?
What happens next is that what the CRTC actually says gets translated as the CRTC doesn't want you to use the N-word anymore in any context. And that's censorship. And we need to stand up against the CRTC because the CRTC wants to censor everyone. And so that interpretation of the CRTC's decision is basically what is said in a lot of different opinion pieces that are being published, including one of them published by over 50 headliners from Radio-Canada. So, you know, the news anchors, the TV hosts, radio hosts, many of them who are very big names in Quebec. And then there's another op-ed that's signed by people who are also very big media personalities in Quebec, but are not necessarily Radio-Canada's employees. And you have also some worried pieces that come out, a former Radio-Canada ombudsman and a former CRTC person as well. So just a whole bunch of heavyweight media folks saying that, you know, this is over the line. The FPJQ, which is the body representing journalists in Quebec, also pushes back against the CRTC decision.
So this is like a chorus of disapproval from everybody who can legitimately say that they represent really the media, civil society. These are Radio-Canada former executives, the former ombudsman. This is all the journalists, celebrity journalists, hosts, and the association representing journalists all in unison saying, fuck off CRTC, don't tell us that we can't use the N-word.
Yeah, exactly. And it becomes a freedom of expression thing for sure and a freedom of press thing.
And the CBC appeals the CRTC's decision.
So on the 13th, CBC Radio Canada finally publishes their official answers to that. There's a press release that comes out. They're saying that they've heard basically all that has been said, including from some of their employees, including racialized employees, so people who haven't spoke out in the public. Because, yeah, as we were saying earlier, there's a lot of people that came out in the media. People who did not utter a word is basically everybody that's like younger, junior, and or racialized. Very few people who within Radio-Canada who were not part of the headliners basically actually said a peep in public. So basically, CBC says in its news release that it's heard from its own employees, including racialized employees, and that it's going to apologize to the plaintiff for its use of the N-word. It's going to issue a warning for the segment that's still going to be online in the future. And it insists that it's not doing that because the CRTC told them to. It's doing that because they know it's the right thing to do. And they're going to appeal the CRTC decision on basically the idea that they don't think the CRTC should have jurisdiction over that kind of stuff. And that if they feel like the CRTC overstepped its mandate, basically just by issuing that decision.
So that sounds like a lot of words to try to ameliorate blowback from their own employees. But if we look at the history of the CBC's response to Lemoore's complaint about the repeated use of the N-word in both languages, we have the show saying we did nothing wrong. We have the ombudsman saying we did nothing wrong. And when the CRTC suggests maybe you shouldn't have done that and you should apologize, we have the CBC appealing that decision.
Yeah, that's right. So it's very complicated, let's put it this way.
Well, it is and it isn't, because the obvious parallel is the case of Wendy Mesley, who was taken off the air from CBC television in English because she said the N-word at work off the air in at least two production meetings. And in one of those meetings, it was also when she was reading out the title of that book. Like, it's an exact parallel, except her case was far less egregious because she didn't say it on the air. And she was taken off the air. And then, months after that plays out, we learn that in French Canada, Radio-Canada, French CBC, the repercussions for it being said four times, including by the host, is that the show thinks it's okay, the ombudsman thinks it's okay, and the CBC is appealing the CRTC's ruling that it might not have been okay.
And the CRTC says, it's okay to say it. Just be careful with how many times you repeat it, and please issue a warning.
Before we talk about anything else, and there's so much more to talk about, how do we parse that glaring discrepancy, contradiction, hypocrisy, that what was absolutely not acceptable on English CBC, on or off the air, is acceptable and defensible and persistent again and again and again on the air when it's French CBC?
Well, that's the $1,000 question, in the sense that that's creating even debates within French-speaking journalists. But basically, the answer is that Radio-Canada and CBC are two different things. But I'd be completely hypocritical myself, that it's not to mention that it's also creating debates within Francophone Black people themselves. The reason you're asking this is, like, why is this discrepancy is for the N-word specifically? And we can go into that for sure.
And so the excuse for why one would have different rules than the other is that like, two solitudes, two different CBCs.
That's right.
I guess that's one excuse or reason or explanation. How about the other one that was offered? I mean, it's kind of moot because, as you say, they used the English N-word with the hard ER. So it's a bit. It's a bit of a red herring, maybe, but should we explore? Is it worth exploring? Like, is it true that the N-word is, like, does it mean something different in French?
Okay, so there's different versions of the word in English. There's the hard ER that's never used in a non-racist way. And then there's the word that finishes with an A that's used in hip hop a lot, that a lot of Black people use themselves. And that's the one that it's not okay to say if you're white, but it's up to debate if you're a Black person, if you're going to use it or not. In French, there's not that duality between the A and the ER. So it's just that one word. And that creates a different conversation. There's a lot of Black authors, especially in the 60s and 70s, even before that, in 40s and 50s, that created this literary movement, the Negritude movement, Aimé Césaire, Léopold Senghor, and they've used the word like a lot, and they use it as a way to basically reclaim their humanity. And it's a way to basically talk about the specific Black way of being a human being, the specific Black human condition. And there's a lot of folks in Quebec who are Black folks in Quebec who are of Haitian background. And in Haitian Creole, the word for guy, a bloke, or just a person is also, and I'm going to say it in Creole, just neg. And that's just a way to say, oh, he's a nice dude. And you can also say that even for a white person. You say he's a cool dude. You would say that, and you would use a version of the N-word to say that in Haitian Creole. And that just comes from Haitian history and how basically we just decided that that word was thrown at us as an insult, but we just made it a synonym for basically all human beings. And that there's also a lot of power in reclaiming that. So I think it's interesting to have those kind of conversations about the different lives, let's put it this way, of the word. But there's ways in which the word has been used in French Canadian history with the hard ER and then translated into the French word. But Pierre Valliere himself, when he wrote the title of the book, in this book himself, he says, when I thought of this book, I was thinking about the word in English with the hard ER. And if in the English translation, that's how it's translated. Mm-hmm. And he uses it as a way to basically equate the experience of African-Americans with white French Canadians and say that they're both oppressed. So there's also like that use of the word that also has created a lot of controversy.
We got to have a really interesting conversation about language and all of the different cultural and artistic ways and how it's different if one person's saying it than another, and it's different in Creole. But like in both these cases, the Wendy Mesley case and the more recent case, they were referring to that book, and the point of that title is to invoke the most harmful racial slur possible, because the point that that title was making was, look at how oppressed French Canadians are. They are so oppressed that they're essentially the white N-words of America.
That's right.
I've heard that device before. There's an Elvis Costello song called Oliver's Army, where the Irish are referred to the same way as white N-words like that. How do I convey to you how oppressed we are? We might as well be N-words the way they're treating us. Like, that's how it's being used there, right?
That's correct. And that could be the right moment to talk about why that metaphor became such a big deal in the history of Quebec's ideas, and why people are holding on to it so much and feeling like their freedom of expression is under attack, when we, some people, including myself, has been telling them this metaphor has been bullshit from the start. And it's not just that you should not be saying the title, it's just that the book itself says something that is pure bullshit.
Well, let's get there. And maybe we'll start, like, I'll present to you, I think, what journalists and others, academics, have used as the rationale for why they must say this. But it's so much, there's so much more I understand to this than that. And I think that what a Wendy Mesley or anybody else has invoked is to say, this is a seminal text in the history of the nationalist and separatist movement. It is.
Which it is, yes.
Which it is. And this is a place for ideas and discussion, and history is included in that. And we try to be specific about things, and we don't talk like in code words. We don't talk like children. Mm-hmm. And I'm not agreeing with the book, and I'm not calling anybody any name. But how can we talk about the history of separatism or the history of nationalism in Quebec without telling you one of the books that this movement and this ideology was based upon?
Yeah, and that's an argument that creates a lot of division even within the Black Francophones community in Quebec. There's a spectrum of opinions on this. There's people who just wouldn't want, just like basically we do in English, just don't want the word to be used ever. And there's people who are like, yeah, let's use the word to name titles of the books. And then there's people who are like, no words should be banned ever. And if I want to write a column with like the N-word 1,000 times written in it, that's fine because that's my freedom of expression. So there's just a whole spectrum of opinion there. And the debate has been messy in Quebec because you have very prominent Black folks, including Daniela Ferrière, who wrote a book called, and I'm going to also just adapt the title, How to Make Love to a Negro Without Getting Tired in the 70s, the book that made him his breakthrough career. He's now a member of the French Academy of all places, an immortal, as we say. And he came out the last time this debate was around to say, of course, we should be able to say the word on the air. And the people, the Black people in Quebec who are saying we should not, are just oversensitive children. I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say it like that, but this is basically what he meant. So that context obviously just creates a whole mess for a lot of white folks who are trying to figure out where they should stand on this. They're just listening to a whole bunch of different voices from different Black people, and they just don't know where to stand.
But to the extent that invoking this simply as like a historical text that's part of the story of separatism, there's a very simple idea communicated by the title that there was this breakthrough book that equated the French Canadian experience to the American Black experience in a very straightforward and, you know, vulgar but emphatic way. And that's sort of where our understanding of this book ends. That sort of, I think the word you used was flattens the true story of that book. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think I'm just going to read Pierre Valliere to you. The very first page of his book, and I'm reading the French text. I'm just going to self-translate as I go. And whenever there would be the end word with the ard, ER, I'm going to use Negro instead. So being a Negro is not to be a man in America, but to be the slave of someone else. For the rich white person, the Negro is basically not even a real man. Even poor white people consider the Negro as inferior to them. They say, work hard like a Negro, smell bad like a Negro, be dangerous like a Negro, being ignorant like a Negro. Very often, they don't even know that they are themselves Negroes, slaves, and white Negroes. The white racism hides that reality from them and gives them the occasion to basically despise an inferior, to crush it mentally, and to even pity it. But the poor white folks who despise the Black people are themselves doubly Negroes because they have a one other step of alienation, which is that racism that instead of liberating them, that racism just imprisons them in some hates and paralyze them, basically in the fear that one day they will have to affront Black people in a civil war. So basically what he's saying is that not only poor white people are Negroes, but they're even more Negroes than real Negroes because they are Negroes that don't know that they're Negroes themselves. So that's basically his point. And he says that in Quebec, there is no Black problem. He says that. Mm-hmm. So he's basically saying that there is no Black history in Quebec. And then he adds a footnote later on saying, well, that's not true anymore. And he says that the real oppressed people in Quebec are the white French Canadian. And he goes on to talk about French Canadians as being an exploited class and talk about basically the whole essay is about the working class and how they're being crushed by capitalism in Quebec and British imperialism. And he just, as I was saying earlier, he just flattens that and makes a straight line between the conditions of African Americans and the conditions of white working class French Canadians. And he does that while he's writing this book in prison in New York, because he's in prison for, he was accused of a murder, actually, of a manslaughter. And he's in prison for 30 months. And while he's in prison, he meets with Black Panther Party members who are in prison when there's a lot of African Americans around him. And while he's being surrounded by African Americans, he writes this book. And I just want to say that as somebody who's both of Haitian and French-Canadian descent, everything in what I've just read or explained makes me want to scream and flip tables and just punch some holes in the walls around me. Because everything in that is completely, completely wrong. I mean, there's, of course, a lot of class exploitation that happened to French Canadians. And Pierre Vallière was a revolutionary. He was a member of the Front de Libération Nationale, the FLQ. He was basically a socialist, communist-ish, and he wanted to make a working class revolution. But to flatten the Black experience to just people who were exploited for their labor just ignores everything about what the history of slavery and taking people from Africa to America was actually like. He says, I'm quoting him again, that French Canadians, were they not just like Black Americans imported to serve as cheap labor in the New World? The only thing that differentiates them, the color of their skin and their continent of origin. So basically that's his theory. And that's why I think the book is wrong, not just the title. The idea behind the book is wrong. However, the book has had such an important life in Quebec. There's still a lot of people, especially in older generations, who hold on to that idea today, which makes it very, very hard to talk about Black experience in Quebec historically and today, because so many people still hold on to this idea. And the reason it's so hard to say this book is wrong without being called a censor is that the book itself was censored when it was first published in 1968. Mm-hmm. The book was censored because Pierre Vallière was a person in prison, a member of the FLQ. This is just 2 years before the October crisis. The government was already cracking down on FLQ member. The essays goes on to basically call for people to raise in arms, basically a working class revolution, just like you've seen in other places around the world at that time. So the book was banned and it was still a bestseller in the sense that people were carrying illegal copies of the book and selling them, you know, under the mantle. That's what happened to the life of the book itself. So that's why when you're saying you should not say the title of the book, a lot of Quebecers go back to that time when the book was banned itself, and they're like, you're the new kind of censor, and you're trying to censor Pierre Vallière. You are not the first person who is trying to censor Pierre Vallière. You will not be the last, and you're not going to stand, and we're going to crush you like we've crushed the other censors before.
I get it. That helps so much. It's a sacred text. It's the third rail, and the idea of any level of censorship or any limitation on that would be perceived as a continuation of that first censorship. But of course, nobody was censoring the book when it came out in 68 because they were concerned about the harms on Black people.
No, no.
It was because he was a subversive radical.
Exactly. And then 2 years later, everybody associated with his organization was just sent to prison by Pierre Trudeau. So there's a real history there as well, for sure.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We hear a lot about the opioid crisis. We talk a lot about the mental health crisis. These are serious problems. These problems affect us all. They've affected my life and my community. They are not intractable problems. I don't know what's going to solve them on a policy level, but day to day, helping people, that's what CAMH does. They do it on the ground when people need help, and they do it through research. The team at CAMH gave our team a tour of their facilities, and we were really just blown away by the incredible, heroic work that they're doing every day. They treat everyone with dignity, and their research is seeking and finding real solutions for everyone around the world. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. So in 68, when he wrote it, I can only imagine that based on what you just read and explained, he knew very little about the Black experience, about Black people, and he was really using the word and the Black American experience as a rhetorical device, that here's a quick and easy way to convey to people the worst abject misery and oppression is to be like those people. But that's not the point of view that he maintained his whole life. And I just read a piece by Tula Germanis in Cult Montreal. Mm-hmm. I just want to read a little bit of this to you. In his later years, Pierre Valliere worried that Quebec ethno-nationalism could degenerate into a xenophobic form of populism. His thought process evolved considerably over the years. As a fierce anti-colonialist, he did not like what he saw happening to Quebec's nationalist movement and denounced politicians more concerned with maintaining their power than fighting for people's rights. He openly criticized the movement of the 90s, and in a 1994 preface to his book, he made it clear that there would be no question of social revolution in this nationalist conception of sovereignty. He advocated for a pluralist, plurilingual, pluricultural Quebec that would give equal rights to all citizens of Quebec.
That is correct. That is basically a summary of what he says and a preface that he adds to the book in 94. Pierre Valliere dies in 98. So in 94, just a year before the referendum, he writes that. He's basically a person that was already skeptical of the Parti Québécois itself when it got created. He was very much, as I was saying, that his use of an N-word was a very clumsy, wrong way to describe his very real struggle or commitment to the working class and how they were being exploited by capitalism and British imperialism in Canada. And that commitment stays true over the years. And basically, when the Parti Québécois gets created, he becomes incredibly critical. He joins it, but still becoming incredibly critical of René Lévesque himself and everybody that he calls basically the bourgeois elites of nationalism. And he criticized this idea that, you know, just creating a strong independent state is going to lead to any kind of liberation. He basically wants a revolution, not just, you know, the same structures that you have within Canada, but just call it Quebec and make it smaller. And so he spends his life criticizing people who want to do that. And he's saying that those people are just trying to do a little bit what Maurice Duplessis had been doing with the Union Nationale, just like appeal to people's xenophobic instinct. He says that nationalism in Quebec or that revolution in Quebec should not just come from the French-Canadian majority. He says that it should be an alliance that comes with all people, including Anglophones, including Indigenous peoples, including Black folks, Asian folks, and that basically all of them need to come together, have some sort of a general assembly when they decide what they want to do next. So that's basically his view. So he just slams on Jacques Parizeau. He slams on Lucien Bouchard. He was very much an enemy of all of those generation of more conservative, you know, nationalists. And it's really interesting that today, after his death, you have the heirs of such, you know, conservative nationalists who are now defending him because they want to defend their right to say the N-word, which in many ways has nothing to do with a lot of the other ideas he had to say. And, you know, it's always going to be a hypothetical question, but I do think that with the kind of commitment that he had to social justice, if he had lived long enough to hear, now that we're kind of more visible, in Quebec media, just how some Black people were just really hurt by his metaphorical use, just how much it's make it so much harder for us to talk about the Black conditions. I'm going to use his word, the Black problem in Quebec, just because he basically stepped over us to make his point. I think part of me would be hopeful that it's a point that he would be able to get himself and be like, you know what, this wasn't my smartest move. I could have made my point differently and the point would have been as strong.
I mean, I guess language does change and meanings change and context changes. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredibly effective title to convey his message at the time.
Of course.
But he evolved and he changed. And it's so interesting to read, again, in this Cult Montreal piece, that he ultimately believed that an ethno-nationalist Quebec, a Quebec that's hostile to immigrants, did not deserve to survive.
That's very much his words. Yeah.
Emily, I am getting a profound sense of deja vu. Hey, that's also French, in discussing this with you. Because we had this conversation before when the blackface debate about whether blackface means the same thing in Quebec as elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the right, don't tell us that your blackface is like our blackface. This is just another imperialistic act of oppression from English Canada. I think it was in that conversation where you struck me with an analogy that just reverberated with just how accurately it conveyed everything, that essentially it always seems to paraphrase you, boil down to like a hockey fight between English Canada and French Canada, between the Maple Leafs and the Habs, where Black people are the puck.
Mm-hmm. That's very much what seems to be going on with Radio-Canada and the CRTC, to be honest, for sure.
It seems that the same thing that all of those Quebec journalists, and there was a senator in one of those open letters, they all got together and they said, look, this isn't about Black people, regardless of what was said. It doesn't matter what was said. Who the fuck are you to tell us that we can't say it? And then that seems to be the same thing that Radio-Canada, CBC, is now saying to the CRTC. Yeah, we agree with you. We apologize for that. Don't worry about using the word. We'll try not to use it again, and we're sorry we said it. But who the fuck are you to tell us that we can't call these people that or use that word?
Mm-hmm.
All of these debates are between people who are not implicated by that word.
Yeah. So I'll start by saying that this is the classic psychology of just Quebec versus Ottawa stuff. You have this knee-jerk reflex of it's important that we have our own conversations amongst ourselves and don't tell us what to do. And this is why I think, you know, the news release that CBC Radio-Canada got out is so interesting, that they said we're doing it because we know it's the right thing to do. We're not doing it because the CRTC told us to. They say that knowing very well that that complaint escalated because they didn't take care of it internally.
Well, in fact, they were defiant. They supported the use.
Exactly.
At two levels.
Exactly.
Internally.
But they say that just because that's the only way to save face and to appease everyone. Because if they don't say that and they say like Radio-Canada obeys to an Ottawa-based organization, there's a lot of people that it's going to piss off and just going to make the social climate even worse. It was the same thing that happened back when Radio-Canada was still doing some blackface in some of its comedy shows. Some of the complaints escalated to the CRTC. The CRTC blamed Radio-Canada for doing it. There were a lot of ruffled feathers because of that. A lot of people were disgruntled and eventually they stopped doing it. But you had to also have that conversation internally and let people come to their own conclusions. Because otherwise it works in the sense that maybe you have a blame, but it doesn't work in a sense that just people just harden on their position. They just feel like they're being censored. They're being oppressed by Ottawa for just being different. And in some ways, appealing to Ottawa-based institutions just makes the social climate even worse. And that applies to basically everything. That's why I always, always critical as well of people, even on Bill 21, just saying Ottawa should get involved, and not understanding what the repercussions of doing that directly would have been. It's because it's a classic thing. It always happens regardless of what the thing is about. There will be people who are like, yeah, maybe we should not say it less, but they're going to be saying it even more just to make a point that they don't have to obey Ottawa.
To perform defiance to the those who would tell them what, and
exactly,
if there's collateral damage or somebody gets hurt in the spray of that, that's who cares.
Exactly.
And yet, if we're talking about how egregious it is that this is this like endless debate between white people in which black people are used as a puck, as a tool, that would suggest, okay, this should be a debate in which black people are included or centered or primary.
But it's so dangerous. It's so dangerous, Jesse.
So talk about that, because you had a conversation with Vanessa Destinée on our French show, Detour. And okay, so this is different than what has been playing out in the Quebec media. We have two black voices weighing in on this, but it was interesting, once it was translated for me, to learn that Vanessa expressed just an exasperation in that conversation. Mm-hmm. That damn, I'm just so tired, I think is what she said. It wasn't your doing that this became a controversy. It is your job to process mm-hmm. these things. You've been writing about this, and you've been communicating in English and in French. And I want to know, like, how is it different when you're debating and discussing this in French than in English?
When I'm debating this in English, I need to explain who Pierre Vallière is. So what needs to be explicited is completely different. I need to explain, you know, as I was saying, like the kind of divisions that exist or the history of the word in French and literature and whatnot and the nuances of that. I don't have to do that in French as much. I do have to explain more in French how the N-word is hurtful, period. Because sometimes people hold on to their grand literary debate and they don't realize how many children are being thrown the N-word at in classrooms and schools to this day, and what's the impact it has on a kid that is on the back seat of their parents' car and the radio's on and they hear the N-word repeatedly and they don't care if it's the title of a book. They don't know that they're maybe 4 or 5 years old. They're still going to ask their parents, why is the person on their radio saying the N-word over? Like, what's that about, mom, dad? And I think that part of the conversation, the fact that when hosts and people, journalists think of the public with a capital P, that like black families are part of the public and we're here and we're listening to you guys, that's something that somehow is still needs to be said. But it's happening while either minimizing or completely ignoring or dismissing the real violence of the word and how it's still being used in Quebec society to crush black people and especially black children down all the time. And it's so easy, I think, for them to dissociate the two conversations because they don't live it. But I think that's the difference with black people having a voice in those debates, is that when I talk about Pierre Vallière and whatnot, I'm still the same person that has experienced the word not in an intellectual, lofty, metaphorical way mm-hmm. as a kid. So I know the violence of it in my skin, and that makes a difference in the kind of thinking that I have. And I think that point about the violence of the word has been made more in English because of, you know, the ER variant that just no black person usually wants to reclaim for themselves ever, even in art. And there is also a strong history of denial of, first of all, slavery, but also racism in French Canadian society that led Pierre Vallière to be so ill-informed that he thought that there wasn't a black problem in Quebec. But it's also an issue, more broadly speaking, in Francophonie as well, where France itself, there's just mainstream thought. Emmanuel Macron will say things sometimes about, you know, just trying to minimize the damage French colonialism had, which makes it that people have a perception that the N-word is not as violent in French, but it's because there is, in many parts of the Francophonie, a difficulty to look at French colonialism and what it did, and which is obviously something that's infuriating to witness as a Haitian. But that's, I think, some of the issue there. It's like displacing the violence of racism on American slavery and British colonialism and not looking at your own history. And I would get why it's so hard for Pierre Vallière's generation to do and for so many Quebec nationalists that closely follow him to do. They're just so invested in criticizing British injustice that they forgot about the French part. And making that shift in Quebec society to look at the French part of things and how yourself can embody those institutions that you've been criticizing when they were happening to you in English. It's a mental shift that is very hard to do, much easier to do with younger generations. There's a great cultural gap there, but nationalist settlers in Quebec have a really hard time understanding their own participation in structures of oppression. And that's, I guess, the specificity of why it's so hard to be having those debates sometimes, and why it's also so dangerous to be taking part in them as a Black Francophone, actually, because it's like you're there as a person who've experienced the violence of the word, but in the way you're being read, you can get conflated as a defendant of British imperialism and English, you know, supremacy, which makes no sense at all. But that's just the mental categories that are available to people. And so because of that, because they think they're punching up when they're punching you, they don't hold their punches.
That is your Canada Land. If you liked it, support us. Click on the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. It takes but a moment to become a member and to get a bunch of stuff that we want to give you when you support our work. If you'd like to hear more from today's guest, Emily Nicolas, you can listen to her podcast that we publish. That is Canada Land's French podcast, Detour. In fact, you may already have them because they are published on this feed. Just look in your archives for the French titles and you can hear a whole different kind of thing. Our excellent politics show, The Backbench, is publishing throughout this summer. Stay up to date with what is happening. It matters. And it's fun to listen to The Backbench. Check it out now. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode was produced with help from Jonathan Goldsby. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our senior producer is Sarah Larniuk. Kieran Oudshorn is our managing editor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. One more time, the special sauce here is listener support, and we need it to keep going. So click on the link in the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. We got wonderful things for our members. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.